Hey, welcome to the Protectors. This is a special episode, a little bit different. There's not going to be any video. And why is that? Because BC is still out in the field. He's still doing his thing. He's still targeting gangs, homicides, and everything else you could possibly imagine with his decade plus years of service out there in the streets. Not going to tell you where he's at or what he's doing, but he's doing a lot of good things, but he's got a lot of really good information. And on the side, he also writes for Skillset Magazine. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Why is my brain? You know, everybody out there, I'm a little focused on moving the studio and everything around right now. But yeah, Skillset. And I kept telling myself, that's the first magazine in like, I think 20 years that I got a subscription to, brother. I just did it. Yeah. And I'm like, what is that magazine?
Yeah.
So how's it going out there, brother? How are you doing?
Oh, it's great. It's great. I'm glad to hear that someone's getting a subscription. Once you hold it, it's like you said, it's 20 years of the old days of magazines where you get, and it's like legit articles, great photography, and with them, it's everything. It's all over the board where some's humor, some serious, military articles. I mean, just, it's good. I'm glad to be on board, and I've been on with them for about 3 years writing, so.
Yeah, and everybody had to really check out his BC Sanders. His articles are really good, and I'm not just blowing smoke as a pizzazz because he's my guest, but they're actually really good. I'm reading it the other day. I'm like, I did not know that, and that's what I want. I want a magazine in my hand to read. I don't want to just get this quick 2 minute skew over the internet. So that's really awesome, man.
Yeah, that was one of the things when they started the magazine. I came on about issue 4. But that was my thing. I was always been an avid reader, and I would read a lot of history and think, how have I never heard of this? And everyone talks about, you can Google, go on the internet. But like you said, these little paragraphs that half the time are not really accurate, and they don't give you the full background on it. So they gave me the opportunity to write kind of in that subject of historical badasses, and just I'll pitch sometimes 5, 6, 7, 8 ideas, and they'll pick a few and I'll start writing them. But it's just one of those things that I think it's important. I want people to learn a lot about history and kind of keep it relevant to today so we don't forget about it.
No, you can't forget about history. And that's the thing, man. You and I were just talking about that with pre-interview, is about everything cyclic. People forget. Mm-hmm. And I say this, I think every 4 or 5 episodes, whenever I talk to a cop or I talk about terrorism stuff, I say, if you remember the 1970s, and not everybody can. I mean, I was less than 10 years old in the 70s. Mm-hmm. But in the 70s, if you know your history, you know that there was terrorist bombings, there was dissent everywhere. The country was not in a good place.
No, I was going to say, I mean, that's one of the things that you look at in the mid to late 70s, and you start to see activity in Chicago based around gangs that are focusing in on ties overseas and doing terrorism. Jeff Fort, I think, was the first American charged with domestic terrorism back then for basically a Libyan plot to shoot down an airline. And Jeff Fort is a longtime Chicago gang member.
That's nuts, man.
Yeah, there's a lot to that case that plenty of books have written on it, but if I remember everything correctly, it was the rumor had been put out there that he wanted to get into terrorism for hire, and an informant went to the ATF, if I remember right, and basically they sold his people the old law, the Vietnam era light anti-weapon.
Yeah.
Rocket, sold him in an inert one, for however much money to, shoot down a American airline. But like you said, that was going on in the late 70s, and
it's a buck, bro. A lot of people don't realize, like, terrorism, a lot of it is for money. It's not just mm-hmm. about power and ideology.
Right.
A lot of those IED makers and VBIDs and everything else overseas, a lot of that's money, bro. A lot of them say, you know what, we blow up a Humvee, and if you get a killed in action or whatever like that, you're going to get money for it. Your family is going to get money if you're on a VBIED or anything, you know? It's just craziness, man.
Once you start kind of tapping into to a network of people and do things like that and make money, and like you said, it's cyclical, you'll see it. A lot of that knowledge start to filter through the U.S., through the prison systems where guys are locked up in federal custody, and start to share that ideology or information. Mm-hmm. And on the home front, who says, okay, and they start buying into it. And like you said, then comes the money, or sometimes they go lone wolf and they are the true believer. And then that's who we want to find, you know, sooner.
You know, the penal system's like the graduate level of education and any type of crime you want to learn. You know, if you go in there and you think about it like, hey, you know what? I'm a criminal and I want to be a better criminal when I get out. I'm not going to get reformed. You're going to go into jail or prison or whatever, and you're going to be like, hey, you know what? I'm going to link up with the right people and learn how to do it the right way so I don't get caught and spend some time next time.
Yeah, and that's where we've seen in the South how nationally recognized gangs have spread here. So, you know, if I tell someone, oh, look, we've got gangs in the South, people kind of laugh and go, it's a couple neighborhood kids. But most cities can trace 8 trade Crips, Rolling 60 neighborhood Crip, you know, multiple blood sets, Haru sets, back to L.A. or up to the East Coast. We have a lot of bloods flowing in, a lot of blood sets flowing in out of New York. And historically, that's who's kind of controlled the South back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And now it's just a proliferation of Chicago gangs, L.A. gangs, and it's through population shifts, through people going away on federal charges and getting brought or recruited in, you know, in a federal prison. And then they come back and go, oh, yeah, y'all don't have 5 Deuce Hoover Crips here. So I'm going to go ahead. I got brought home, or I got, you know, made or recruited in when I'm in federal prison, and they get back to their, you know, home city. They can reign supreme and just start to recruit me. Like an infection, man, it just spreads.
Well, it's money and power. And think about it this way. Yeah. It's almost like we're seeing pyramid schemes all the time. How many people are trying to sell you essential oils? I mean, if you really think about it in a really basic ideology of not even the crime aspect of it, but money and money and money. If you're the guy at the top and you're controlling all these sets and everything, that money is going to a lot. You know what? You start at $100 at the street. $3 or $4 gets to you, and the more people you have in a street, the more people you have spread out.
Yes,
the more money. It's
100%. Yeah, 100%, and that's what has taken a lot of agencies down here. Because I'll do classes that I designed from the ground up, and I'll actually explain how certain sets operate. Because not all the gangs are operating exactly the same, but what we've noticed is the ones that have spread the quickest are the ones, like you said, that establish a quick pyramid, and they'll give someone rank, and then that person will then be able to recruit, and you, you get a certain percentage. So like some of the East Coast blood sets started charging like $31 a month, or some of them were $31 a week. So they hold these meetings once a week, and you've got, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids having to pay $31 a week. Mm-hmm. And they can't pay, and then the organization or the set will say, yeah, all right, get in the bullpen, and they get beat by 3 or 5 people, you know, depending on what the set is, and they're getting punished in front of their peers, which then creates that cycle of, well, next week I'm going to have my money one way or another. So, you know, some of these guys I debriefed and kind of built rapport with, not all of them are gun-toting killers. You know, they're getting involved in, like you said, like that pyramid scheme where they need support, they want that network, so they're kind of told this is all about the community. We're gonna take care of one another. You pay these $31. We put it basically in a lockbox. You get arrested. We got money on your books. We'll take care of your people. You know, you'll be taken care of. And then these guys go out there and put in work for the higher ups, get locked up, and then you listen to jail phone calls, and I mean, it's sad, but they're crying to their higher ups saying, hey, where's my money? You know, what's going on? These higher ups are saying, like, sorry, I don't have any money for you right now. Times are tight. So it starts to kind of break down that resolve. But the middle management wants to keep recruiting because they want to keep getting those dues, like you were talking about. pyramid.
Deuce, man. It's crazy. You don't, if you know, the bad thing about crime, let's look at it from the Fed angle. The Fed angle, you know, you're a good special agent. You get out there, you know, you do your time. You finally learn about what you're doing a little bit after 2-3 years. And then, you know, 5-6 years in, you get a tour to headquarters and you never go back out to the field. Mm-hmm. And you're losing this psych, and everybody forgets about what they learned. So yeah. You never have, like, you know, in our world, you never have, like, someone working the same crimes for, like, 2 decades. And if they are, they're very specialized.
Right.
And, you know, yeah. I'd imagine the same things in a PD. People need to move up in rank or, you know, you're not going to have as many, you know, different – you're losing a knowledge base. So you and I are having the same conversation that you and I probably would have had 10 years ago. And then two guys would have had this same conversation 10 years before that.
Yeah.
Because I remember, man, like when I started out in the 90s in the Army and everything, learning about gangs because – obviously, there's a bunch of people that came from gangs.
Yeah, right? Especially in the 90s. Yeah, the 90s is when it peaked or when it first got on CID's radar.
Mm-hmm. Weird, man. It's just bizarre.
I remember in the 90s, they had the assault down at Bragg. I wasn't stationed at Bragg. I was at Fort Campbell. But they had basically a Nazi skinhead go out, if I remember right, and kill a biracial couple, which put on the map for Army CID. And they started coming to all these infantry units, and I remember having to get buck naked, you know, in company commander. And if you had tattoos, you had to explain every tattoo. And if, from what I understand from some people, is that CID learned, well, our Nazi skinhead movement or infection or whatever is somewhat small, but our street gangs, we just realized, got a lot of them, you know, just based off of the tattoos.
And, you know, growing up in Jersey and getting into the Army and, you know, I was in artillery, so we had a lot of, it was very diverse. Mm-hmm. And I had guys from Compton, you know, and all sorts of shit. And I'm like, what is going on, man? I never heard about this stuff. And then learning about it. And then later on getting into law enforcement and getting out in San Diego and seeing all the gangs and all the different things. And it's just, listen, man, it's unless you come up with a way to kill that pyramid scheme and go to the top and get all that.
So there is a way. There is a possibility, not to cure the problem, but at least disrupt the cycle of violence that happens in the cities. And a lot of it is kind of geared around the intel side, knowing who the sets are, knowing everything from their hand signs, their rank structure. I mean, some sets will do things with tattoos, how they wear their flag or how they wear their bandana. Yeah, all those things, the more intel a police department learns, the more they can develop those sources. Because then them down and explain to them, I would explain to people, I know everything from your hand sign to the day you got brought home, where that 9 was or where that meeting was, you know. So you're already on the losing end. And we don't want that, you know, because I truly don't. It's like if I can convince a young man or woman nowadays, I mean, we've got quite a few girls that have joined and they're shooters. They're not just carrying guns, you know, like in a purse or something crazy like or a backpack. It's like they're carrying them in their waistband, wanting to put in work and shoot people. But if I can convince that person they are not part of the secret society that has all this power and that they're going to move through these ranks and not have any problems, you see it almost like the recognition in their micro expressions where they realize, wow, all this time I thought that the police were just in uniform answering calls and harassing people in traffic stops. I had no clue. You know, these units are plain clothes and know all this. And then two, want to take a step extra and go, you know, what is your background? What do you want to do? Like I always ask a lot of guys, what do you want to do legitimately? What kind of job? And if I can find an interest they have, I do my best to network and get them at least lined up with some type of employer or at least show them this is how everyone else is living. And then I also explain to them the next few months of your life are going to be like this. You know, you're going to be riding in cars. Guys will be flashing guns. You're new. You know, if they're a new person, you're going to have to put in work, which means trigger time, get the charges. And when you get locked up, this is going to happen. So I'd explain to them when these things start to happen in your life, you will understand I care and my team cares more about you than your own set. And at any time, you can contact us and say you want out or you want to at least work or cooperate or whatever you want in life, we're going to try our best to help you out. But if you sever that tie and continue down that path, and when you're looking at, you know, life in prison, you sadly, you'll only have yourself to reflect on that. We're doing everything we can right now to help you. So years ago, I couldn't really do that when I was on patrol because I didn't know enough. And I would ask senior officers and drug detectives about the gang aspect, and they would just blow me off like, look, rookie, just go answer your calls.
Yep.
But I was trained in the academy, that mindset of this is your area or your beat. And if someone gets hurt or shot or killed, not it is your fault, but you better be part of the solution, either solving the crime, getting information from, you know, network of sources in the neighborhood, store clerk, I don't care who it is, apartment manager, who somebody needs to be providing information. And that mindset 18 years ago was utilized to start building rapport. And then every gang member I encountered, I just ask them a bunch of questions and explain to them, hey, I'm going to be here for 30 years. You're apparently going to be, you know, whatever, whichever set you are, you're going to be here too. So, you know, we can work together and build a rapport oftentimes on the common enemy. So if I knew, you know, one set had problems with another set, we would kind of laugh and joke about that set, but in turn, you know, try to build that rapport, because I would never expect a gang member, you know, inside of a 1 minute conversation to, you know, put information out there or say, yeah, you're right. You know, everything people have told me is a lie. But once I can have longer conversations with them and spend more encounters with them, then they understand this is a losing situation. Even if they make it to the top of that pyramid, that just means they graduated to the alphabet boys or ATF are gonna focus on them, and they're gonna go away federally on RICO charges or OCDEF charges. To, you know, the local drug units picking off the lower hanging fruit. So using, like I was saying earlier about the, not necessarily we can solve the gang problem, but by implementing proactive measures on, okay, this is our most violent set in the city. This is how we know that. We know what their future moves are because we've developed sources in middle management who are telling us what these plans are. And this is how we can disrupt it. And then it's just complete focus. Every drug charge, every type of investigation. Mm-hmm. We've got guys that are committing frauds now. So you bring in a fraud unit and go, okay, this guy hates this guy. We know this guy's got an AK, but he's also running, you know, fraudulent credit cards or whatever. So we want to hammer him and get those guys off the criminal landscape in the world's most violent dodgeball game, you know, where it's just shots fired every night. And then after a while, that starts to break that cycle. And then, so, you know, you can have another unit actually dismantling the full set in a RICO. And it's sometimes it feels like playing whack-a-mole, like you're just kind of hitting around an area. But if you do it strategically and you actually kind of apply knowing who the gang members are and what their motives in the gang are and sometimes what they're capable of, then you can focus on that.
Understanding and having human, like you said, human, man, you need it.
Yes.
And if you're not developing sources out there, I always tell people, you can never put anybody behind jail, put anybody in jail behind a computer. I mean,
right.
You can,
oh, yeah.
You know, but not really.
I mean,
you really want to disrupt and dismantle a major organization. But, you know, the other thing you brought up too is, you know, you and I grew up probably normal, regular, go to high school, go to school, whatever, get out, mm-hmm. go to college. If you don't want, you go to the army. But if you don't grow up with a moral compass,
mm-hmm.
and you just see the gang life, you just see the drug life, you just see this kind of life, you don't understand what's out there. And PD and having people having a first encounter with anybody of authority is going to skew their mindset. Is this guy just busting me, this girl or whatever?
Yeah.
Even if they hit a social worker, they hit juvie or whatever, it all depends on what that first encounter is going to be.
Yes, and that's – so for me – my background, I had a very solid family, you know, background. I mean, parents were divorced, but mom worked two jobs, made the rules, you know, you follow them. But I was a little skater kid in the '80s, punk rock and hardcore, ran from the police quite a bit. I was always respectful if I got caught. But I also saw the end of that where, you know, cops are kind of on that, power trip. And when that would occur, then we were kind of like, all right, now it's more of not anti-police, but more of you can understand how someone can get, not aggressive, but can kind of understand why someone may not trust the police or may not like the police because their last encounter was, you know, multiple curse words, being frisked and never really, you know, I mean, I got searched with a buddy of mine in a town. We were seeing some bands play. Officers walked up behind us, snatched us, put us up against the wall and started frisking us. I was probably about 14, had no clue why or what was going on. And then it was all the making fun of the haircuts and that sort of thing. Of course, that was, like I said, late '80s, very early '90s, somewhere around there. So, but going, you know, growing up in an era where I had to have some type of, focus, I had to know what I was going to do. And for me, it was the Army. I didn't care about college. I didn't want to do that, but went to the Army and did 4 years in the infantry, then got out and got a psychology degree for free because the government paid for it. And, I worked for UPS and they paid for college as well. So, graduating debt-free, I could go into law enforcement and not worry about making any money.
Well, exactly, man. That's where it's at. You know, I always tell people, if you're going to go in, make sure you get everything you can,
yeah.
College fund, GI Bill, yeah. Whatever. It's worth it, man. They paid for everything I've got. I mean, I paid a little bit here and there, but all the way up through the doctorate. So I'm never going to kick my time in the service at all, man.
No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, bro.
Yeah, no. I was just going to say that is one of the things that I always tell a lot of young people that I encounter is for me, that train changed the trajectory completely. I mean, if I wouldn't have gone in the Army, I never would have gone to college ever. I probably never would have pursued law enforcement and would not be as happy as I am now. And knowing that the things that I've done on the job were not harassing people and, you know, just sitting in a parking lot waiting for a 911 call. I've been able to do a lot of really good work and actually see a lot of the effects. So I always praise the military, and I usually will post something every now and then about being in the land of the BDUs back when the camo, you know, but just trying to, I guess, show my respect and be very appreciative of what the military gave me.
Yeah, you know, I'm on the twilight of my career. Whenever I talk to anybody that's an LEO, I'm like, man, I could go back and do some more because my days of, you know, putting cuffs on people or putting anybody in jail are over. And it's really weird, man. It's really weird.
Yeah. And it's changing. Like you talked about earlier, everything being, you know, cyclical, that a lot of people now will talk about, you know, community policing. We got to be about the community policing. Now, it's interesting to me because I'm like, that's the way it's always been. You know,
broken windows, 1970s,
yeah,
community policing.
I'm like, I mean, I'm pushing almost 20 years. And it was that way when I came out of the patrol. Was you better, like I said earlier, you better know your people, get the information and work it, you know, be proactive.
That's what community policing is. It's knowing your people. It's not looking, you know, targeted enforcement where there's a broken window.
No.
It's knowing your people and being a human.
Yes, you know, I call it
authoritative, but you have to be human.
Yeah, this is what I teach this a lot to the recruits and to in my classes. Make a ripple arrest. You know, you when you make an arrest on a 12-hour shift or however long a shift is, you make an arrest, you're going to be at the jail processing. That means somebody in uniform is not in your area keeping people's heads down, you know, with guns or what. And worst case scenario, but I worked a very active beat like that to have multiple gang sets. So I knew I had to be in the area. But if I were going to make an arrest, I want it to be somebody with a gun or somebody with a beef with someone or someone that the neighborhood or someone has said, that kid sitting on the power box is out here every Friday night. And usually, you know, there are gunshots or something goes on over there and we want to get rid of people hanging out here or whatever it is. So it's always that ripple arrest. But then someone may look at, say, my numbers and go, wow, you stopped 20 cars last night, but you wrote one ticket. Every car I'm stopping, I'm I'm finding out they live in my area and I want to know where are the problems, you know, get your headlights fixed, whatever, wear your seatbelt. I don't want to see you die in a wreck, but give me some information about the problems in your area. And so that way we can focus on it.
It should never be about numbers, and it should never be fiscal.
No.
By fiscal, I mean, you know, traffic stops for money. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. And I think a lot of that.
Hold on. Let me clarify that for the audience. I'm talking about like speeding tickets, issuing citations that are eventually bring money. I'm not talking about like shaking people down.
No. Yeah. I'm glad you clarified that, because I was about to jump in. But I know what you mean, that a lot of information's come out the last few years about research and agencies maybe not understanding that effect of, you're patrolling an area because there's violence there, so you have more officers there. You're stopping more cars. But if you're writing tickets on every little violation on a person who's already battling financial hardship,
Yes, exactly.
So that was always my argument for, you know, I'd stop a lot of cars, but I always hated writing tickets for that reason. And I think now, I do think that most jurisdictions have kind of realized that you don't go into an area just because there's a lot of drug sales and just start arresting everybody because you're picking up random people that just happen to be in the area, or riding a bunch of traffic and patting yourself on the back and saying, we made 15 arrests last night in this area where we had two homicides. And it's like, you didn't arrest.
Did you get the people who did the killing?
Yeah. You could have stopped those people and basically said, hey, this is what's going on. Sorry, I've gotten these types of misdemeanor violations with you, but I'm really here because I want to solve this homicide or get information. And 9 times out of 10, if they live in that area, they may know something and they say, okay, I'm going to keep it moving. It's like, okay, hey, what have you got? Let me get that info and then put it into the puzzle pieces and see if we get it.
And so it's not us against them, and they're not. It's been like that for, you know, since policing started.
Yeah.
Where you get skewed, you know, warriors and they get it to where they, hey, you know what, I just want the getting home at the end of your shift thing. And I'm like, you can still get home at the end of your shift and still be a human. You have to know when to turn it on. Don't turn on 99% of the time, because you're going
to
burn.
Well, right. And this is like one of the things that I teach to recruits a lot of times, or newer officers in my gang classes. You know, if you're working an area constantly, you have to build rapport with the citizens, and the citizens will know who you are. You may not know who they are because you're encountering so many different people, but they'll know who you are and oftentimes give you a nickname, and everybody will know you by that nickname. But by doing that and building that rapport, that reduces the uses of force or the encounters where violence is going to happen against an officer, because the citizens in the area already kind of know that officer. They see that officer every day.
You're a known quantity, you know?
Exactly. And then, so they can kind of read what's going to happen and what's going to go on. If someone walks up as a robot and their hands are in a steeple and they're yes, sir, no, sir, this is what you need to do. Put your hands here. You can come across in a very relaxed posture, in a very nice posture, and an inviting posture, but still know what your plan is in your mind. If they run for the cut, or they reach, or if they're already giving you those indicators of an armed citizen, you know that. I mean, you know how to handle yourself. Mm-hmm. Like you said, that switched on warrior type of mentality is very tough to overcome for some areas when officers have done that for several months, and sometimes kind of get the department a bad image, you know.
Once you realize and you remember that the thin blue line is actually a line between you, the good and the evil, and it's not a line of like, hey, you know what, a cone of silence or us against them, that's it, you know.
Yeah, you know, and the interesting thing is when people research the amount of corruption now, and I'll say now, like within the last 10 or even 20 years maybe, in law enforcement is dramatically decreased compared you know, 40 or 50 years ago. So I do hear people say that a lot of times, that thin blue line, or that blue wall of silence. And I'm like, I don't understand that, because as long as I've been an officer, I've never even experienced that. The worst things I've seen is maybe someone violating a policy or something, but I've never seen like criminal actions. I've never even heard of like on a mass scale, these agencies with corruption and they're like, you know, the Serpico days. I mean, those, luckily, like as a profession, it is amazing that officers go out there and encounter people and are getting guns off of people who actively are trying to get away and are still able to do that often without harming anyone and are not, you know, doing like most TV shows where these cops are crooked and they're stealing money from drug dealers and they're actually worse than the gangs. I'm kind of sick of that whole that whole
mentality.
Yeah, it's so silly.
And now it's like every TV show you watch always has the good cop. If it's a police procedural, there's always bad cops, man. And it just puts on the mentality of it. It's like, you know,
and usually they don't last. That's the thing. Early on, most agencies will pick it out. If they don't get it in the hiring process, they'll pick it out on patrol. A person will either get we call it that golden option of resigning or getting fired. And that's a good thing. Like you see a lot of times early on and go, ah, that person sometimes may not make the best decisions. Like I said, not like some corrupt cop or anything. It's just a person who's probably not going to make really solid decisions. And eventually they resign or, you know, get fired for violating too many policies or whatever. But yeah, I would not be so focused on gangs or working, you know, homicide as different assignments throughout. I would have, if I were like in the Serpico era, that's what I would have been internal affairs and going after crooked cops. You know, fortunately that it's just not, that's not the number one problem. That's, it's just become such a great profession, constant training. I mean, push for education, constantly reading. I mean, some of the smartest people I've met are cops. And some of them did not even go to college. You know, they may have gone to the military. Yeah.
You know, education's fine.
Yeah.
I tell people, I'm like, the only reason I have all this education is because, for one, I just love learning. And two, the Army paid for it all. So I'm like, hey, if you're going to give me free education, I'll do it.
Well, and that was,
on $100,000 and
right.
Like, I don't know about that.
Yeah, no, that was my thing. I was able to do a bachelor's in psychology, and like I said, it was free. But I enjoyed learning once I got out of the Army and realized, you know, you go to class, I'd fall back to the library, study, go to class, fall back to the library, and I did that for 4 years, and wanted to graduate, you know, as high as I could in my class and actually learn something to apply it out in the field, because I knew in college I knew I was going to be a cop. But yeah, that's awesome, man. Yeah, the big thing like is just the reading and constantly learning and people taking pride in what they do. And actually, most citizens reflect that. I know the news won't show that sometimes, but it really is nice when citizens will go out of their way and say, hey, you know, I know y'all have a tough job, you know, and that's always, it always feels good. It's just kind of reassuring.
Well, brother, I do appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, show. Man.
Read you on Skill Set magazine, where I have my first subscription. You know, my dream has always been to be in a magazine. You know, I don't care how many times I've done like the news or court TV or written books. I've only ever wanted to just be in a magazine.
So, There,
just, you know, hey, when I retire, whatever, just put me in a magazine.
Well, okay.
Just kidding.
That's a good pitch. No. I was going to say, I pitch. So, If they pick it up, or even if somebody else can do a better job of it. I like
BC,
it, man.
You be
like
safe
it
out there, brother.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We'll do it, buddy. 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 Yes, sir. We'll do it, buddy.